On this week's show, I will do my best to answer your book and reselling questions and more. We've got reselling news from eBay, Poshmark, and once again from the United States Postal Service, and a double dip of what sold. What is up, Galaxians? Welcome to episode number 226 of the Galaxy CDs Rocks and Flips Reseller Talk Podcast. My name is Ryan, and I will be your host. In today's episode, like I said, we're going to handle, or try to at least, a bunch of questions that were submitted by listeners and viewers. Thank you to everyone who reached out, either over on Instagram or on YouTube, with questions for me for this week's episode. We do have some reselling news that'll be actually the last segment this week. And then as part of the questions and the normal what sold, we got a little bit of a double dip on some what sold. But let's jump right in and get it kicked off with your questions. So this is one that I get from time to time. If you follow me over on eBay, you know I've got over 10,000 listings, and I talk about these big, massive bulk buys that I've done over the years, 8,000 plus CDs and 15,000 odd books, which to be fair, took me nearly all summer to pick up because I did it in many, many trips. But nonetheless, Sissy, 6025 over on Instagram asks, how do you keep track of all the big lots of books you get? So just to give you a little bit of an idea of what my process is, when I buy a big lot, I don't really do much to track them other than to get them accounted for in my accounting software. They go into a section of my storage that is what most people would probably describe as a death pile that may have at any given time anywhere from 300 or 400 to 3,000 or 4,000 items in it. It's my inventory to be worked. As far as I'm concerned, that is just potential profit that has not yet been realized. But I don't really keep track of them at that stage in any kind of way. They're just there in boxes and in tubs. But then as I start to work through that inventory, I will essentially, I have a kind of a three-part process. I do a little bit of research on the item. As I list the item, I will then assign it to an inventory location. So I've shown pictures over on Instagram previously, but my warehouse is full of bins and boxes that all have some kind of inventory location on them, A1, A2, B1, B2, and so on. And as I list the items, I have a list of available inventory spaces with me as I list, and I'll assign that to a particular place, and then I will use that number in the eBay and Etsy custom SKU field so that when I go to pull that item, if it says it's in B1, I know exactly where to go in the warehouse to pull that item. So that's essentially how I keep track of them. Initially, I account for them in my inventory, but I'm not really keeping track of them because I don't need to find a particular item yet at that point. Once they're listed, they get assigned to an inventory location that I can then add into eBay and Etsy to quickly find the item, and that's essentially how I keep track of them from there. It has been a terrific system. I cannot recommend, if you're a newer reseller and you don't have some way to track your inventory once it's listed, I can't recommend highly enough that you do that if you're going to have more than 10 or 15 items, because there's nothing worse than what we have here for the second question. This is from Mel NM3. Do you ever lose items? And if so, how do you handle it? I rarely do, but I did today. I looked and looked for a DVD I recently listed. I know it has to be around here somewhere, but after hours of searching, I finally gave up. And since you brought it up, what is your favorite flavor of ice cream? So I'll tackle that second part first. I'm going to give you two. So when I'm just going to the grocery and buying ice cream to have at home, I go to Kroger and I love their artisan vanilla bean. So vanilla ice cream probably sounds really unexciting, but it's just terrific. If I'm going out for ice cream, a local Cincinnati area favorite, Grater's, I love the black raspberry chip, which is, as it would sound, a black raspberry ice cream with chunks of chocolate in it, which is just divine. So there you go. That's my two choices for you for ice cream. So do I ever lose items? Yes. Yes, I do. Despite my best efforts and this elaborate inventory system that I've created, I still occasionally lose items. Generally speaking, though, probably 95% of the time, I am able to ultimately find them because I kind of know how my brain works. So I just described that inventory tracking system. So A1, A2, A3, and so on. And I typically try to list in batches sequentially. So I'm doing those three maybe in order. So let's say I have assigned an item and I put it into eBay as being in A2. And when that item sells and I go to pull it, I find that it is not in A2. What do you do? So knowing how my brain works, I listed those kind of in sequential order. So the first thing I do is look in the two inventory locations to either side of that, A1 or A3. Did I mistakenly just hit the wrong number? Was I transitioning from one box to another and just put the wrong number in? Probably 90% of the time, it is in one of those adjacent locations, and I'm able to find it and move on with life relatively quickly. Sometimes it's not, and I've made a different type of error. So I have A inventory locations and B and C and D, and I have all these different boxes that might be numbered up to well over 100. So my next, if I've assigned it to A2 and it's not there and it's not in A1 and it's not in A3, then I start going through the other alphanumeric twos. So I'll look in B2, then I'll look in C2, and then I'll look in D2 and so on. And again, the ones that I couldn't find previously, almost always I find there. Probably, I would say once, maybe every 45 to 60 days, I will have an item that I have just completely screwed up and I can't find it. And what I do in that case is I reach out to the customer and explain, hey, I have turned my warehouse upside down trying to find this item and I'm not able to locate it. My apologies. I'm, of course, going to refund you in full immediately. You can look for that in the next few minutes. And then I make them an offer. If I do happen to find this item in the near future, I will reach out to you and offer it to you for sale first at a discounted price. I have had a couple of times where I just randomly found the item in fairly short order after being unable to locate it and reached back out to the customer and ultimately did make a sale. So don't give up on finding the item because, as you said, it will turn up. And I always, like I said, will reach out to the customer and say, hey, if I find it and you haven't bought one elsewhere, I'll make you a deal on the one that I can't find right now. Secondly, don't beat yourself up. We're all human. We all make mistakes despite our best efforts. You're going to lose items, whether you have 50 items or 10,000 items. It's almost inevitable that somehow, some way, a mistake will have been made and you won't find it. Don't sweat it. Don't kill yourself over it. It's not worth it. It's just one sale among many. Do some additional listings and move on with life. Don't worry about it. So Mel, thank you so much for the question and try that ice cream. Brian Kirk, 3036 over on Instagram says, what do you listen to while listing items? I do listen to some podcasts, but mostly I listen to music. For those of you who know my story, I used to own a CD and record store years ago. I have been a lifelong music fan. I'm a Spotify premium subscriber. Last year, my Spotify annual Wrapped report said I listened to something like 90,000 minutes worth of music, which put me in the top 1% of all Spotify listeners. I don't know necessarily that that's something to be proud of, but that's what I listen to. I listen to a lot of music of all genres, pretty much. I just love good music. So that's generally what's going on in the background. As I said, occasionally I'll throw a podcast on, but in a lot of cases, I feel like I get distracted with a podcast like this. I want to listen to what they're saying and I want to focus on what they're trying to tell me, and I kind of lose track of what I'm doing. And as per the last question, I don't want to lose items. So music tends to work better for me. But I know there's a lot of people that they watch YouTube or they have Netflix on or whatever the case is. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to kind of keep things interesting. But my go-to is music. Annette, XS Baggage, has a couple of questions here. The first one was, what do you wish you knew before starting a YouTube channel? How difficult it was going to be to grow a channel. And to be fair, I probably haven't. This is a pretty niche podcast. Not even all resellers are going to be interested in this style and type of content. I'm trying to do something a little bit different with a, well, let's call it a less dramatic version of things like reselling news. I try not to be too harsh on the platforms. I'm not trying to be easy on them either, but I'm not creating mountains out of molehills. But it's just, I understand that this kind of content isn't for everybody, but I don't do maybe as much promotion of the channel, and I'm maybe not networking as much as I could with other resellers to try to grow the channel. But yeah, I wish I knew how difficult it was going to be. That being said, I still enjoy doing these. I enjoy the format. I enjoy the interaction with all of you. So I, again, as I always say, I appreciate that you take some time out of your day or out of your week to listen to this show, to submit questions and so on. I truly appreciate the 500 to 600 people that view and or listen on a weekly basis. I think I've said this before. I have to remind myself that if you told me that every week 300, 400, 500, 600 people would show up at my house to listen to me talk, I would think that's pretty amazing. So I need to understand that that is the case here on YouTube and with the podcast as well. Her second question was also, what's the best mic for people to start out a podcast? So as I've mentioned on this show on more than one occasion, I'm a bit of a mic junkie. I currently have 4 different microphones. I've had a couple of others over the years that I've sold. I could do a whole episode probably or more on this topic. I will make 2 recommendations. Number one, if you are interested in starting a podcast, there is in my featured channels, there's a guy named Tom Buck who does a terrific job reviewing gear and talking about how to do a podcast or how to do YouTube. He is a terrific guy, a friendly, funny. He's always got these just really corny puns. He is really, really good. He's a former teacher, so he presents things in a very digestible way and covers all kinds of gear from really inexpensive stuff right up through the most expensive gear you can find. So if you really want to know about gear and podcasting, I strongly recommend checking out his channel. That being said, if you're just looking for a starter kit, if you will, I will link to this. It will be an affiliate link in the show notes in the video description below. But this package over on Amazon is a great starter package right now. It's $100, $99.99. It includes a Samson Q2U handheld dynamic microphone. So this is not, it doesn't look like, if you're watching on YouTube, this. It is not the kind of traditional podcast-looking microphone. It's a handheld, like, TV reporter-style microphone. But it is a dynamic microphone, which does a good job of kind of rejecting room noise. So if you're doing this, I'm in a pretty well-treated space here. I've spent some time and effort to make this small office space as not soundproof, but as sound friendly as possible. But most people, when they're starting out, they're working at their desk or they're working in their living room or whatever, and you get a lot of ambient noise. So a dynamic microphone is the kind that you want. This is that. It's also compatible with both just a USB connection directly to your computer where you could record into software like GarageBand or Audacity. So that's great. If you decide later that you'd like to expand into an audio interface or a mixer or some kind of sound processor, it will also work with an XLR connection. So you've got a microphone that can grow with your podcast if you decide to do it. This kit also includes a shock mount, so you don't get all the vibrations if you hit your desk or you bump the mic stand. It also includes a boom arm, so you can mount the microphone to your desk, and it has what they call a pop filter that'll help prevent what they call plosives. If you're talking directly into the microphone, sometimes you'll hear those pops of air. You don't want those. This has a filter that will help eliminate those. This whole kit, the microphone you can buy sometimes as cheap as $60 by itself, but you're still going to need a stand. You probably still want a shock mount and so on. So this kit for $100 would be my recommendation if you just want to start out and see how it goes. Then you can turn into a mic junkie like me and have $1,000 or $1,500 worth of microphones to do a once-a-week podcast, which makes no sense, but I like the gear. So hopefully that helps. If you decide to do that, again, if you would use that link, it is an affiliate link, and Amazon will give me a little bit of props for that. I appreciate it. Moving on, this question came over, I believe, maybe even by email. So when you are sourcing, how do you comp books? I use Google Image, eBay Image, but as you know, sometimes it can be a bit frustrating. Do you have a secret sauce for knowing which book to grab, or is it just years of experience? I sometimes see other sellers using a scanning tool when going through books. Is this something you do as well? This kind of ties into the next question from Big Dre Graphic Tees. What kind of scanner do you use for books and DVDs? So I'll answer that part of it first. I don't. I don't sell on Amazon FBA. And to be fair, I've talked about this numerous times. The eBay ISBN catalog is so bad and so broken that scanning the books and using those codes does not really give me any relevant information. So I don't scan. The other reason that I don't is I'm primarily looking at older books and items that don't necessarily have barcodes or ISBNs. The ISBN thing only came out in the late 60s. So anything prior to that, is not going to have one anyway. When I go to like the big book sales and I see the guys with the scanners, they're generally speaking in a completely different part of the sale than I am, because I'm looking at the older vintage books. And what I do to answer the first question is I type in the author and the title. Sometimes just the last name, sometimes it'll be just the title. I do it that way rather than trying to scan or use a UPC or a barcode. Again, because that information, particularly on eBay, is not always accurate. I've seen wrong titles, wrong authors, wrong artists on CDs, wrong publishers, wrong dates, and so on and so forth. So the information that I get back, if I use that number, just isn't accurate enough for me anyway. In many cases, as I said, there is no barcode to scan. And lastly, I'm trying to search when I'm researching an item in the same way that I think a customer is likely to search if they're looking to purchase that item. And the odds are that that person is not putting in an ISBN or a UPC code. They're typing in whatever it is, Alex Haley Roots, because that's what they're looking for. So when I do my search for research to try to find comps, I try to search it like I'm a customer looking for that book, because those are the results that I think are going to be the most relevant. When I go to list the item, I want my item to show up in that type of search. So that's how I do that. I've used eBay Image a couple times for things that are not books, but for books, CDs, and so on, author, artist, title, and search, and then kind of refine it from there is my method. As far as a secret sauce for knowing, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it is just the experience, whether it's books or Hot Wheels or anything that you might, sports cards, anything that you might be trying to sell. As you become more and more experienced, you'll learn which types of things to look for. And it's one of the reasons I do the What Sold segment pretty much every week, talking about various types of books. The specific book that I give you may not necessarily be relevant, because the odds of you finding that exact book are not necessarily all that high, but finding old mechanical drawing books or old religious books or whatever the case may be, those themes and those types of books, if I can help you narrow down the types of things that you should be looking for if you're looking for books, that'll help speed your process. I don't do like contemporary fiction. I'm not trying to buy Tom Clancy and Danielle Steele. And I know there are people who still do those sorts of books. That's not my game. Again, it goes back to another reason I don't use the barcode. I'm looking at older types of items that a lot of other booksellers just really aren't looking for. So hopefully that helps. If you're watching on YouTube, please feel free to leave me a comment. If you do it a different way, leave additional questions that I will follow up with in a later episode. All right, moving on. What else have we got here? BuzzardBid commented, what motivates you while doing mundane listings for hours? What do you do when you feel tired or lethargic in order to get through them? So for starters, I guess the first and most obvious thing is the realization that if I don't list, I don't sell. And if I don't sell, I don't eat. and that's a pretty good motivator. As a full-time reseller, it might be different if you're part-time and you're not reliant on the income from this little process. But that's pretty motivating, knowing that if you don't get through this task, you're going to see a negative impact in your results. So that's first. The second thing I do, I've talked about this regularly on this show. I am a big believer in setting goals, and I set daily and weekly listing goals. I do them because I'm doing so much volume just by listing count. You'll see if you follow me over on Instagram at Galaxy CDs Rocks. Every week I talk about how many listings I sold and how many new listings I created. My goals are based on just raw listing numbers. You may choose to do dollar volume. You want to list $1,000 a week or $2,000 a week or whatever that number is. But set yourself some kind of goal and then break it down. Whether you start with a monthly goal and break it down to weekly, then daily, or if you start with daily and then work out the other way, but set some kind of manageable goal that you can track. I do offer on my Amazon page, and there will be a link in the show notes in the video description below, daily planners that I use on a regular basis to just kind of tick off what I'm doing throughout the course of the day. Not only does that keep me on track, but it does help motivate me. You get that little hit of dopamine every time you check one off and you're a little bit closer to achieving your daily goal. Mine, generally, on a day that I'm not sourcing, I try to do 20 to 25 listings. On a day I am sourcing, I might only be doing five. I try to do at least five a day, every day except Sunday, so that I can kind of keep feeding the beast, if you will. But that's kind of that process, just to stay focused and keep a goal and work towards achieving that. So the other thing that I do is I take regular breaks. So I will generally do somewhere between 5 and 15 listings, and then I'll stop. My listing process is all on the mobile, so I'm sitting at my photo booth. I've got my pile of inventory to be worked on my left-hand side. I get them in the booth. I do the research. I take the photos. I create the listing. Then I move it into the inventory bin, and I do the next one, and I just repeat that process 5, 10, or 15 times, however I'm feeling, and then I'll stop, and I go to my computer, and I hop on List Perfectly, and I do my cross-listing to Mercari and to Etsy. Now, you may say that's still listing, and it's still part of that mundane process, but it is a different set of tasks. It's different. And that provides a little bit of a break from doing the same thing over and over and over again. Usually when I'm done with that, I'll give myself 5 minutes. I'll do a puzzle on my phone. I'll go make another cup of coffee, whatever it is. And then I'll come back and I'll do 5, 10, 15 more. That usually gets me to about lunchtime. I'll do my cross listing. I'll go have some lunch. I'll come back and then I'll do again 5, 10, or 15 more to kind of finish out the day. So breaking it up into a goal, a digestible, achievable, trackable goal each and every day, and then breaking that further down into like small manageable chunks that you intersperse with other activities helps me at least keep it from being really, really tedious and mundane. There's no way to slice it. Listing is the least fun thing probably that we do, but it is probably one of the most important. They're all important. You can't list if you don't source. So, I mean, I guess you could make the argument that sourcing is more important, but if you don't list it, you can't sell it. So staying focused on that. And again, kind of from the beginning, remembering that the only way you make any money to pay your bills or to fund your vacation or whatever it is you're trying to accomplish with reselling is to get those things listed. So thank you for the question. Buzzard Bin, 5W and Hall commented, have you ever used an ozone generator to remove the old book smell? I have not. I did get at one time, I'd picked up a big lot of vintage hardcore science fiction books that had a really bad smoke odor. And I picked up on Amazon, I can't remember what they're called. They're these bags of, it's almost like lava rock, but it's odor absorbing. You put a bag of this stuff in with the books in a Rubbermaid tub and you seal it and it supposedly absorbs the odor out of the books. It didn't eliminate it, but it did reduce it. But I have not used an ozone generator to remove the old book smell. Some people like that smell, and we're going to kind of get into that in the next question here. I try not to alter the books too awful much. Some people like that, the scent of the old paper and the binding and whatnot. So I always disclose if there's a strong smell of any kind, be it smoke or a book that's obviously been stored in a basement that has that slightly musty odor, I will disclose that in the description. But I'm not spending a lot of time and effort or expense trying to eliminate that because I don't know necessarily what the customer at the other end may expect. His second question, I'm also interested in cleaning books. Any tips for light foxing? I saw a person sanding edges. This all seems like work that takes away from listing time. I could not agree more with that sentiment. I actually have a friend who does that. She sands the foxing off the page edges and tries to do like basic book repair and so on. I don't do any of that. Number one, I'm not trained in it. And there's at least the possibility that I'm going to make the situation worse rather than better. So I don't try to do anything beyond like a basic cleanup with a paper towel or some kind of like wet wipe to clean the cover and maybe the edges. I don't sand the edges. I don't try to repair any damage to the books. I list them as they are. I disclose any flaws. I photograph them and their flaws in the listing so that people can see exactly what they're getting. And then I let the customer make the decision on whether that book fits their needs. I don't spend a lot of time. And again, I'm not selling $1,000 books here generally. My average selling price is probably $20. So it doesn't pay me to spend a lot of time trying to make a $15 or $20 or $25 book look like $1 million. A customer is going to make their own decision on whether they want to clean it further, whether they want to have it rebound, whether they want to clean up the edges by sanding it or whatever the case may be. I'm not trying to take that decision out of the customer's hands, number one. And number two, I'm not trying to spend that time when I could be more productive doing an additional, gosh, who knows, 4, 5, 6, 8 listings while I'm cleaning up an old book that maybe somebody doesn't really want cleaned up to begin with. So no, I don't do any of that. As long as you're properly disclosing the condition of the book and you get it presentable, for me, in my business model, that has proven to be sufficient. I buy WNY. I've noticed that you've tried to diversify your business with no limit items like print on demand and printables. I'm interested in finding something like that too. I'd like to hear your thoughts about those ventures or other ideas you have cooking. So I do have on my Etsy shop, print on demand, t-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, that sort of thing. And on Amazon KDP, I do have, like I mentioned earlier in the show, the kind of planners and journals and that sort of thing. They have not done, to be fair, what I had hoped they would do. I may do $50, $80, $100 a month in those areas. It is not proven to be big money for me. To be fair, I'm not an artist. I'm not a designer. So my expectations maybe should have been a little bit lower. I see these people on YouTube all the time that claim to be making thousands of dollars doing this. And I am not one of those. I have not created any new items in either of those categories for quite some time, and I probably won't because, much like the last answer I gave, I feel like my time is better spent doing either sourcing or listing items I already have rather than trying to create a new item like a t-shirt or a coffee mug that may or may not ultimately sell at all. So it's once they're done, you can essentially forget them. You don't have to do anything. I don't print them. I don't ship them. I don't do anything. They're just there, and they're there forever. It is a little bit of extra money if you like doing that sort of thing. And if you are artistic, I think there is an opportunity there to make pretty decent extra money, but it's not something that has worked exceptionally well for me. My friend Brian Clark, what is the meaning of life? Brian, the meaning of life is 42. If you get that reference, you can let me know down in the comments below. Not to get too whatever, as we head into the holidays, I don't know if meaning of life is whatever, but I will say it's a short little venture that we get here. Hug your loved ones. Spend time with people and that you love and enjoy being around. Spend time doing the things that you enjoy doing and the activities that you want to do. We only get one crack at this unless you're the kind of person that believes in reincarnation. This is a one-time trip, man. We get whatever we get, 40, 50, 80, 90 years. One time only, man, make the most of it. It's one of the reasons I started doing this. I was not, financially, I was fairly fulfilled, but emotionally and spiritually and psychically, I was not enjoying what I was doing. I was not enjoying how I was spending my time. I was not enjoying really necessarily all the people that I was around. And I made the change in my life to get into full-time reselling to fix those things. And it has not, I will, It's unlikely I will ever make as much money doing reselling as I made as a retail store manager or even in auto sales, but my life is so much better. I am able to spend time with friends and family and doing the things that I want to do, and that to me is more valuable than gold. So if there's some hint of a meaning of life there for you, you're welcome. I would also point out, I watched a video the other day with Professor Brian Cox, and he talked about, and this is a total down a rabbit hole, but as far as we know, we are the only intelligent life, at least in this galaxy, if not in the whole universe. And we are the only form of life that, at least that we're aware of, that assigns meaning to things. And he was of the mind that that is both awesome and a terrible responsibility for us to preserve our existence. If we are the only representative of meaning in the galaxy or in the universe, and we don't figure out how to get along and maintain the existence of the human race and somehow manage to snuff out the only hint of meaning in the galaxy, wouldn't that be a terrible, terrible thing? So I would leave that question with that. The last one I've got here, Alexander M. I'd like to see a top 20 book finds list. So would you settle for 10? I'm going to give you my top 10 sales that I was able to find. Now, the first problem with this is that within eBay, you can only go back 2 years of sales records. So in my top 10, there is one that is older than that that I knew roughly when it happened, and I was able to find actually an old episode of this podcast and identify that particular book. But I'm pretty sure there are probably books during the first 2 years that I did this that I have missed because I just didn't have any way really to find them. So, but I do have my top 10 book sales that I am aware of that I will present, and then we're going to get into what sold this week. So let's jump right into that. So for this, I don't have any fancy pictures. I just did a spreadsheet because I downloaded the eBay information and then just kind of cut and pasted that. I do have a couple here that were sold on other sites, so we're going to start kind of at the bottom of the list. Selling for $129.99 over on eBay, a book called Blood in West Virginia, Brumfield versus McCoy. It was published in 2014, hardcover with its dust jacket. Very difficult book to find. I had picked this up at an estate sale for, I think, about $2 or $3. It sold again for $129.99. A book I talked about fairly recently, A Mystery for Mr. Bass, a Mushroom Planet book written in the, I suppose it was probably written in the 1940s. This particular version was published in 1960. It was a ninth printing hardcover. Picked it up at an estate sale for $2, and it sold over on Mercari on an offer for $164. The New Roman Missal by Father Lassance was published by Benziger Brothers back in 1945. It was in a leather case. This was in a fairly recent episode of this show. It sold over on eBay for $169. I think I picked it up for $2 or $3 again at an estate sale. And you can see already in just three titles a wide range of books, a history book, a kind of a child's mystery and fiction book, and a religious book. So all types of books can sell and occasionally bring pretty good money. So as I said earlier, I tend to avoid like mass market popular fiction, but older books, man, can be pretty solid. Number four, Sold to the Ladies, Three Girls on a Barge by Dorothy A. Bennett. This was published in, I want to say, the 1940s, if I'm not mistaken. This sold over on eBay for $179.99. It was another one that I had picked up at an estate sale for $2. A book from 1939, Democracy and World Dominion by Edwin Schoonmaker, published by Richard R. Smith. This also sold on eBay on an offer that I sent out for $212.49. I don't recall on that particular book how I came by it. I want to say it was part of a big lot of books, but I won't swear to that. Next up, Second Wind, The Memoirs of an Opinionated Man. This was Bill Russell's autobiography that was published in 1979. It is out of print. It is very difficult to find, particularly in good condition, which mine was. I had it listed over on Etsy, I think for like $270-odd, and I was running a sale on Etsy, and that book sold for $242.99 plus shipping. I owned that book, I believe, for $2 from an estate sale buy. This one you're going to see again in a few minutes, and we'll get into some further details on this. Historical records of the 9th Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers from 1914 to 1918. This was a hardcover book about a particular group of soldiers during World War I. This sold on Etsy for $279.99. This is a book that was picked up at an estate sale again for a couple of bucks. Another military book, The Fighting 36th, A Pictorial History of the Texas Division in Combat, World War II. This book sold on eBay for $329.99. This is a book that I covered, I think, a couple of weeks ago as well. Number nine, this was actually a comic book. This was part of a big bulk buy of comic books and magazines and other books that I bought at the last day of an estate sale. I essentially cleaned out the place. I was into this thing for, I think, about 10 cents. The Blue Beetle, number 3, from July-August of 1940. It's a 64-page comic book by Fox Publications. Like I said, I was into it for about a dime. It sold for $358 plus shipping on a best offer over on eBay. And number one, this is the book that I had to actually research back into a previous episode to find. This was one of the biggest sales I've ever had on eBay. I have had some electronics that brought a little bit more money than this, but this was a terrific buy. Memorable American Speeches, Volume 3, Slavery. This was published by Lakeside Press back in 1909. It was something that I had picked up at a garage sale for a dollar. It sold on an outbound offer for $467.49. So that is, as near as I can tell, my 10 best sales over the last at least couple of years. Again, a wide variety of books from history to military to kids to religion. There is no one particular genre that seems to do significantly better than the other. It's just a matter of, like anything, learning which ones are good and which ones are not, and then sorting it out from there. With that said, let's get into this week's What Sold. Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. This was a Modern Library Edition hardcover with its dust jacket from 1946. Picked this up fairly recently at an estate sale for $2. It sold on eBay for $21.99 plus shipping. Another of those military books. This was one I picked up for a dollar at an estate sale fairly recently. 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines Landing Force Mediterranean from January of 1961. This is the tour book for that particular group. Again, picked it up for a buck, had it listed for $29.99 or best offer. Got a watcher, sent out my normal 15% off offer, and sold it for $25.49. Those military books that are essentially like yearbooks, I've talked about yearbooks pretty regularly here. I generally, if I can get them for $2, $3 or less, I just buy them because they almost always sell eventually to either someone who was in that group who didn't have or has lost the book, or a family member. So I always grab all of those military type yearbooks. This is a series of books I've talked about previously, the Collected Works of Honoré de Balzac from the Giant International series. This is a big volume of books that were all published in the 1920s. This particular one was from 1926. This was part of a big lot of books, part of that 15,000 book lot. So I'm into it for less than a nickel. It sold for $29.99 plus shipping over on eBay. This was part of the that same lot, so this is another sub-5-cent book, and when I first grabbed it out of the pile, I almost didn't look it up because I thought, this is probably not going to be worth anything, and it turns out that it was. It did take a while to sell. I've had it listed for some time, but Reflections, A Life in Two Worlds, written by Bob Thomas and Ricardo Montalban. If you remember him from, what was the show? Fantasy Island. He had a long career as a leading man, an actor, and then later in his career, he did car commercials for Plymouth or Chrysler or one of them, and this show. And I just thought, this guy was not super serious, whatever. This book's not going to be worth much. And as I researched it, it turned out it was worth 30 some odd dollars. It was a hardcover written in 1980. Again, I own it for less than a nickel, and it sold for $32.99 plus shipping. So again, to just hone in on that example once again, even having spent the last 4+ years doing this, I still get fooled sometimes. I'll look at a book and say, that's probably not worth anything. But I take the time and I look it up, and sometimes I find a winner. Speaking of yearbooks, here's another one. The Record of the Class of 1942, the University of Pennsylvania yearbook. This is one I picked up. I think this was part of the lot that I talked about last week where I got 30 yearbooks for $25. This sold for $32.99 plus media mail shipping. I did get asked by someone unrelated, and I didn't have it in the question and answer section, but they had commented on a video about, can yearbooks be sent media mail? And the answer is sometimes, because some of these have advertising in them, local businesses that paid to support the publication of the yearbook. And in those cases, those books technically are not eligible for media mail because they contain ads. Not all yearbooks, however, do contain ads. So if you get one that doesn't, you can ship them by media mail. Another book, The Roses of Malmaison by Gabby von Schanten. This was a first U.S. edition from 1968 on Meredith Press, hardcover with its dust jacket. I've had this for a little bit, over a year probably. I'm not sure where this came from. I think this was part of the big lot of 15,000, so I think I'm into this one for about a nickel. Had it listed for $44.99. It's in my current 20% off clearance sale and sold for $35.99 plus shipping. For sale over on Etsy for the week, the American Cyclopedia Volume 6 from 1883. This was a leather hardcover published by D. Appleton and Company. It was in pretty rough shape, as a lot of these like late 1800s leather-bound books are. The leather was cracking and peeling, but there's not a lot of these out there. This was another one, part of a big lot that I own for probably less than a nickel. It sold for $39.99 plus, again, media mail shipping. I haven't had one of these in a while. I talk occasionally about bound magazines. So issues of magazines, either an entire year's worth or an entire volume's worth, that have either by the publisher or by the individual been bound into a hardcover. Sometimes they can bring pretty remarkable money. This is one from the 1920s, the Cincinnati Business Women's Club, Cincinnati Women's Business Magazine from 1924 and 1925. Had, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 issues of this kind of newsletter magazine in a hardcover binding. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the cover is not in terrific shape. The cover on the spine had split all the way down the front and was kind of folded over. I listed it for $49.99 or best offer. Again, sent an offer out to a watcher and sold it for $42.49 plus shipping. Hollywood Hoofbeats, Trails Blazed Across the Silver Screen. This was a 2005 hardcover with its dust jacket, a first printing about horses in Western movies. I was at a sale maybe a month ago that had some of my bookselling compatriots had already been through this sale because I saw them as I was going in, and there was this huge, huge table full of books about old Westerns and Western movies and Western radio serials and so on that they had, for whatever reason, not bothered apparently to look at because there was all kinds of value there. This one, apparently out of print, very difficult to find. I picked it up for $2. It sold for $69.99 plus, again, media mail shipping. So, again, it's an area that, when I walked in and I saw the table and I knew that the other guy had just left, I was like, man, I can't, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that none of this stuff would have had any value to him, but I'm going to start looking some of them up. And lo and behold, I bought, man, I don't know, 30 or 35 books for about $2 a piece. And they're all $20, $30, $50, $70, $100 books. And this guy just didn't even look at them. So thanks, my guy, for not totally raiding that sale. I made out pretty well there. Here's another book from 1969, Roland Ward's Records of Big Game, the 13th edition. This was a first printing hardcover, essentially a chronology of big game record kills, if you will, from the late 1960s. Fairly unusual piece. I'd never seen anything like it. This was part of a big lot also. So again, I'm into it for next to nothing. It sold over on Etsy for $89.99. And now your flip of the week. We just covered this in my top 10 sales of all time, but we're going to cover it again because I have some other interesting things to talk about with this. So again, the historical records of the 9th Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers from 1914 to 1918 that sold for $279.99. Interesting old book. This actually sold to a buyer, I believe, in England. So this went international shipping, sold on Etsy, but through their off-site ads program. And my loyal listener, P. Diddy T-Tube, has commented a couple of weeks now about being really frustrated with Etsy's off-site ad program. So if you're not familiar with it, if you sell on Etsy, you, as a new seller, I'm pretty sure you can opt out of this program. Once you've reached a certain threshold of sales, you are no longer eligible to opt out of it. You're required to participate in it. But what it is that they will advertise your listing on other sites, so like Google, as a sponsored ad. And if someone purchases that item through that ad, through clicking that particular link, Etsy charges you an offsite ad fee. The issue with that fee is that it is really, really high. I talked a couple of weeks ago about Etsy having a really low final value fee rate. It's like 6.5%. The offsite ad rate is 15%, which is a big, big bite. And again, it's one of those that applies not only to the cost of the item, but they also apply it to the shipping. This particular book, the buyer requested like first class priority, whatever. It was $89 in shipping. So Etsy charged 15%, not only of the price of the book, but of the $90 that the customer paid for shipping. So in this particular case, this book sold for $279.99. I had $11.60 in processing fees, the normal final value fees of $22.36, and then the offsite ad fee. I guess the shipping was actually $64, so $63.94 for shipping. The offsite ad fee was $51.59 on top of the other fee. I had commented in response to his queries about the offsite ad fee, probably half of my sales, I guess, at this point on Etsy, sell through the offsite ad program. This one was expensive enough that it countered most of that. At $51.59 to me is egregious. It's too much money for that fee. My net profit on this item ended up being a little over $185, which is still not hateful, but $235 would have been a lot more fun if I wasn't paying that $52 fee. I try to remind myself that this is probably a sale that I might not have made otherwise because this person only saw this item because it was advertised as part of that program. But there have been instances where a customer in Australia or somewhere has purchased a $15 or $18 book, and by the time you add in the $28 to $30-odd of shipping and pay the offsite ad fee, I've had sales that looked like, with shipping included, they were $50, $60, $70 that I've made $3 or $4 on after this offsite ad fee. So you can let me know, again, if you're watching on YouTube, what your thoughts are on the offsite ad program on Etsy, if you've been hit by it, if you've had instances where you actually have lost money. I know there are sellers who have, particularly on lower priced kind of print on demand type items and so on. So that was a huge, huge bite, $51.59 in just that single fee. So again, let me know what you thought of that. That having been said, it's time finally. Sorry for those of you who like to get the news out of the way early. We're doing it late just because of the structure of this show, but let's do some reselling news.
News updates.
So it's that time of year. It's fourth quarter, and the sites are all starting to really promote themselves and your listings. eBay has a post over on their community page. Hooray for the holidays. It's official. We have arrived at the holiday 2023 shopping season. They say across the U.S., consumers are expected to open their wallets, though not too wildly or wide. As I talked about over the last couple of episodes, eBay and Etsy both forecast pretty weak fourth quarter numbers. They are not expecting the same kind of growth necessarily that some of the other firms are projecting for Q4. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. But they are, again, in this post warning sellers that it's not necessarily going to be that big of a Q4 growth. Q4 is still going to be strong, obviously, but maybe not as strong as people expect. They are being ever more conscientious and strategic with their spending. They're searching earlier, they're digging harder, and they're budgeting carefully to find that perfect, memorable item. In survey after survey, shoppers are ranking price as a key consideration, with quality also topping lists, which they say is a combination to eBay's advantage. They say, let's add to this two other trends. First is that more shoppers are launching their holiday journeys on marketplaces versus in-store or by brand, starting at sites like eBay to gather ideas and formulate lists. Second, they say they are more receptive than ever to buying, gifting, and receiving items that fall outside of the traditional new in-box bracket. This has been something that's been growing over the last several years, where gently used and upcycled and recycled type items that sell on sites like eBay and Mercari have become much more acceptable as gift type items. So this highlights that they are shopping pre-loved fashion, vintage handbags, discontinued toys, refurbished electronics, collectible cards, and more, exactly the varied selection that you deliver on eBay. To further demonstrate these trends and how we expect the holidays to unfold, check out some stats from our fourth annual eBay Ads Holiday Guide. There is a link to that guide in this article, and I, as always, will link to these stories in the show notes and the video description below. But they note that 71% of U.S. consumers surveyed begin their holiday shopping experiences on online marketplaces. So Amazon, eBay, Etsy, that sort of thing. They're not necessarily going to stores. They're looking online. So that's a big, big number. eBay says they rank in the top three. Respondents named eBay as a top three marketplace destination for holiday shopping and great deals. So that bodes well, potentially, for eBay sellers. 79% of holiday shoppers spend a lot of time exploring their options before making holiday gift purchase decisions, and 45% of holiday shoppers prioritize product quality in their search for holiday purchases. That goes back, again, to something I harp on all the time about making sure your listings have a lot of photos and are very clear about what the item is. The more you can promote the quality of the item and the professionalism of your services, the more likely you are to make a sale. So bear those kind of things in mind. This season, they say value is valued. Pre-owned is no longer taboo. To capitalize on this shift and deliver you buyers, we're engaging people where, when, and how they're shopping, highlighting the exceptional variety and value you offer at key moments on each step of their eBay journey. To illustrate, eBay says they kick things off in early October to get ahead of the pack. Fast forward, and we're now in the midst of holiday prep, emphasizing home decor and hosting self-gifting like cookware, candles, and bedding, as well as treat yourself, fashion, and luxury in anticipation of parties and gatherings ahead. They highlight some important dates coming up: Cyber Week, which is 11/23 through 11/28, so essentially the end of this week into next week, which includes, of course, Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, and Giving Tuesday. So we've now got a big stretch of very specific dates and days around Thanksgiving. There are some key dates they point out in December as well. The first Sunday of December through the 3rd is historically one of the biggest shopping days of the holiday season. The reason for that window or that day being a big deal is, you, as we talked about last week, you start to bump up against shipping deadlines. So if you're buying online, you need to get those purchases in early. So get your inventory listed. For those of you, like we talked about earlier, who find that process to be mundane, aggravating, and frustrating, there's no better time to get over those feelings than now and get them done. They also highlight a couple of their different ad campaigns that they're running. So eBay is opening up the floodgates to try to draw people to their site. All that being said, they still project being anywhere from down 1% to up 5% for the holidays. Poshmark has also published their holiday gift guide. They're highlighting things that people are apt, again, to be looking for on Posh, so that you can try to tailor your listings to those things. They talk about the vintage lover, things that are trending and viral, festive and handmade, luxury enthusiasts, the wellness guru, the active adventurer, things for the family, things for the home, tech gadgets, and then they have gift guides for items $25 and under, $100 and under, and 250 or under. If you're interested in that, again, the link will be in the show notes and the video description down below. You can go check that out as well. eBay announced this week a more secure way to access your account. Now, there are a lot of sites that have done this. This is the first that eBay has done it. They're now offering what they call two-step verification. It's a great way to add an extra layer of protection to your eBay account. And by selecting an authenticator app as your preferred verification method, you can enjoy a more secure and seamless login process. This added security layer helps us verify your identity during sign-in, reducing the risk of unauthorized access to your account. There are various authenticator apps that are available. They talk about a couple in this thing. It's essentially an app that provides a one-time passcode that you then have to put into eBay as well. It's a six-digit passcode. Generally, it's generated by the authenticator app and is stored locally on your device. Doesn't require an internet or mobile network service. It's based on a secret key that's shared between the app and the eBay app or website. Using an authenticator app as a method for two-step verification, they say, is more secure than traditional methods such as SMS text, voice, or email one-time passcodes. It's also less susceptible to risks like code intercepting, SIM swaps, porting, and network vulnerabilities. When the one-time passcode is sent to a device in your possession, it makes it difficult for hackers to intercept it. You can visit your account setting page to enable this and then select authenticator app as your verification method. They recommend Google Authenticator, Microsoft Authenticator, or an app called Authy. You can also check out their step-by-step guide on how to set it up. So if you haven't done that and you're concerned about account security over on eBay, I use the Google Authenticator for several other sites. I will probably activate this for eBay. It's one more layer of protection, and it's fairly quick and easy to do. Last week, I talked about the pirate ship announcement that the United States Postal Service was kind of sliding in a little stealthy bit of a price increase by changing some of the things that were eligible for a particular discount through sites like Pirate Ship. There had been no announcement at that time, and I mentioned this, that eBay or Amazon or any of the sites were going to be affected by this, and this has been confirmed by the folks over at E-commerce Bytes. Sellers got word last week that the USPS would be increasing rates for certain service providers starting November 18th, but eBay and Amazon have reassured sellers this week that labels printed through their marketplaces would not be impacted. As I just mentioned, Pirate Ship informed sellers last Wednesday that this thing that applied to Connect e-commerce was going to be changed. Pirate Ship is a participant in that program, so rates in certain things are going up. The key thing to note, again, eBay is not raising rates. Amazon says they are not raising rates. So this may be a good time, particularly if you use Priority or USPS Ground Advantage as your primary shipping methods. If you're on Pirate Ship, maybe to look and compare the rates again between eBay and Pirate Ship to make sure you're getting the cheapest rate available. Speaking of Priority and Ground Advantage, we talked several weeks ago about the upcoming January price increase for what the post office considers, I believe, market dominant rates, which is first class stamps, media mail, and all that that was going up. They had not made an announcement at that time about price increases in their other services. Well, they have now. Sellers will pay over 5% more to ship with the post office in 2024. Boo. This is, I knew it was coming, but you always hope that maybe you're going to catch a break. We did not. The cost of shipping a package via the United States Postal Service Priority Mail and Ground Advantage services will increase over 5% in just 9 weeks. And in some cases, it's going up by a lot more than that. Online sellers, of course, will also pay higher payment processing fees due to higher shipping costs, and they will also pay higher commission and final value fees to sites like eBay and Etsy, since, again, those marketplaces consider the total price plus shipping when assessing commission. So, again, this 5% increase is also going to impact your final value fees. You get hit from essentially every angle when these fees go up because all of the fees that are tied to those amounts also increase. So it's a nice way for eBay and Etsy to make a little bit of extra money, but it's at the expense of us as sellers. I guess I don't, to be fair, have any expectation that eBay would do anything to help compensate for that kind of thing. It would be probably almost impossible to do, but it is really frustrating when you have these twice a year price increases and then you get hit from the other side as well. Anyway, the rate increase announcement comes one day after the post office reported a $6.5 billion loss for their fiscal year 2023, which one group of mailers and shippers has attributed in part to unprecedented postage rate hikes. So this is an interesting angle on this. Keep U.S. Posted, a nonprofit advocacy group of consumers, nonprofits, newspapers, greeting card publishers, magazines, catalogs, and small businesses, called for an end to postage increases that it said were triggering a dramatic loss in mail volume. The post office last raised rates on July 9th, as we've talked about on this show regularly. They are increasing rates essentially twice a year now, in January and in July. This has been going on for a couple of years, so they have had, I don't know, six price increases in the last 2 years. I was watching a video the other day, a guy talking about media mail. His video was only, I don't know, a year and some change old, and the £1 rate at the time he was doing it was $2.89, and it's now going to be, in January, over $4. That's a big jump in that short of an amount of time. The post office has already announced last month that the rates for those market-dominant services were going to increase. The cost of mailing a first-class letter is going up. In addition to first-class mail rate changes, prices for media mail, library mail, and so on are going to increase by about 4%. P.O. boxes are going up 2%. Insurance is going up 1.6%, and so on and so forth. This announcement today covered those competitive services. On average, USPS Ground Advantage prices will increase by 5.4%. Priority Mail will increase by an average of 5.7%, and Priority Mail Express is going up by 5.9%. However, as this article points out, averages can be a little misleading. Priority Mail flat rate packages are going up 9.8%. So if you use the padded flat rate envelope or any of their flat rate boxes, you are really going to get hit. Your price increase is going to be almost 10%. Sellers will pay 8.5% higher rates for the popular medium priority flat rate box. So 9 to 10% price increases for flat rate stuff. Ouch. They also said Priority Mail Commercial will rise by 4.4%. Priority Mail Cubic is going up by 4.8%. And again, the Ground Advantage, both the standard and the cubic, are going up by 5.2%. So you're going to get hit pretty much no matter how you ship your items. If you're using the post office, it's going to go up. They are also raising non-standard fees. These are things that are applicable to competitive products. They're going to see a 20% price increase as the Postal Service continues to try to discourage the use of parcels with what they describe as non-standard dimensions. So for Priority Mail, this is stuff like golf clubs, big kind of odd shaped or sized items. If the length is greater than 22 inches, the surcharge is only going to remain at $4. But if it's over 30 inches, it's going to go from 15 to 18. If the cube is over 2 cubic feet, the surcharge is going to go from $25 to $30. If it's Ground Advantage, the 22-inch length, again, is going to remain the same at 4. 30-inch or longer is going to go from $7 to $8.40, or over 2 cubic feet is going to go from $15 to $18. So big price increases on the horizon in January from the United States Postal Service. That's bad news. Any way you slice it, that is, you know it's coming twice a year, but it still stinks when you finally see it. And the increases are not small. These are 5% and in some cases 10% or more price increases. And again, that all rolls downhill into your final value fees and so on. So be aware that that is coming. To be fair, I don't know that there's really much we can do about it, but eat it. It's one of the reasons that I've talked about that I got away personally from the free shipping model. So at least I'm passing that portion of the increase, unfortunately, directly on to consumers who are already squeezed by inflation and higher debt service loads and so on. So there's no good answer, unfortunately. Again, if you're watching on YouTube, you can let me know in the comments what your thoughts are and what you plan to do, if anything, to try to offset all of that. So, my friends, that is going to put a wrap on one of the longer episodes I've done in a while. Thank you again for spending a little time with me today as we head into the holiday. Thank you for those of you who submitted questions. I hope you got something out of those answers. If you did, you know what's coming. If you're watching on YouTube, hit that thumbs up button. If you're not currently a subscriber to the YouTube channel or a follower of the podcast, please consider doing that as well. And please share this show with your like-minded reselling friends so that I can solve that problem of what I wish I knew before I started YouTube, that this was hard. I hope everybody has a terrific Thanksgiving. I'm going to be totally straight up. I'm not convinced that there will be an episode next week because of Black Friday and all the stuff going around along with the holidays and travel and seeing family and the fact that it's not always a big week for reselling news. I may take next week off from the show. We'll wait and see, but don't be surprised if come next Monday morning there is no episode. I wish all of you a healthy, happy, and safe Thanksgiving. And in the meantime, it's time to sell. Thanks, guys.
You have been listening to the Galaxy CDs Rocks and Flips Reseller Talk podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you again next time.